I won't ask if you can hear me. I should ask, can you see me? I'm Eileen Beard. I have been a nurse midwife for over 34 years. I'm a family nurse practitioner. I've been involved in home birth, birth centers, hospital birth, and I'm a senior practice advisor with the American College of Nurse Midwives. I'd like to introduce my wonderful colleague over here, Elaine Germano. Elaine has practiced midwifery for more than 30 years and has a background in midwifery education and public health administration. She also works for the American College of Nurse Midwives and is the Senior Education Policy Advisor. Elaine will be doing the second half of the presentation. And I have no disclosures. So the title of our presentation is Promoting Evidence-Based Practice in Maternity Care Through Use of a Checklist. So to help explain this topic, I'd like to take this opportunity to tell you about my recent trip to Italy. The first thing that I did, I went to my computer and I printed out my checklist of all the important things that I needed to take with me on my trip. It also was a reminder to me of all the things that were really unnecessary and I should leave at home to make my journey a bit easier. And we can really take this a step further and think about how we can use a checklist to help providers have best practices in maternity care, and we're going to be talking about that. Because as you know, there are big problems with the U.S. maternity care system. And I love this quote by Ina May Gaskin, a society that places a low value on its mother and the process of birth will suffer an array of negative repercussions for doing so. And I think a lot of what we're going to be talking about today really ties in with the last presentation. Provision of maternity care is an essential responsibility of all countries. A society's infant mortality rate is considered an important indicator of health status because infant mortality is associated with socioeconomic status, access to health care, to the health status of women of childbearing age. So let's talk a little bit about how we're doing in the U.S., because we're not doing so well. First of all, our preterm rate has in general been increasing, and our rate of low birth weight has been increasing. Now, I will tell you, I was very happy to receive something in the email this morning from the March of Dimes. They put out their annual report card, and although they gave the U.S. a C, our statistic of 12.7 in 2007 is now 12.2 in 2009. So we are making some improvement. But they mentioned in the report that some of the reasons for preterm deliveries are due to the unnecessary interventions that we subject women to in the hospital. I see some of you nodding your head. So there were 4.3 million births in the U.S. in 2007, the last year for which statistics are known. As I mentioned, our preterm rate has increased, but we've finally seen a little bit of improvement. Babies born weighing less than 5.8 or 2,500 grams are considered low birth weight, and low birth weight babies are at increased risk for serious health problems.
Go back.
I'm not good at multitasking this way.
You want me to do it?
Sure. Okay. At the population level, thank you. At the population level, the proportion of babies with low birth weight is an indicator of a multifaceted public health problem that includes long-term maternal malnutrition, ill health, mothers working long, hard hours and standing on their feet, and poor health in pregnancy. On an individual basis, low birth weight is an important predictor of newborn health and survival. About 1 in 12 babies in the U.S. is born with low birth weight. Some studies suggest that individuals who are born with low birth weight may be at increased risk for chronic conditions. So it's not just a problem that's happening at birth and we're dealing with these babies and they're fine. There can be other long-term sequelae such as diabetes, hypertension, or heart disease. The World Health Organization, thank you, recently reported that the U.S. has fallen to 30th in the world on rankings for infant mortality, an alarming indication we're just not doing all that we can to address maternal child health needs. The U.S., one of the world's wealthiest countries, consistently has higher infant mortality rates than other developed countries. The percentage of U.S. births delivered prematurely rose until recently. At last, we're making some strides. And as I mentioned, a lot of this rise has been tied to interrelated trends such as an increase in multiple births, a greater reliance on cesarean, which, as we've just heard, leads to many, many morbidities, and the induction of labor in pregnancies. Next slide. Now, cesarean is increasing for all women in the U.S., regardless of medical condition, age, race, or gestational age. And preterm delivery and induction is clearly related to the increase in cesarean rate. They're all interrelated. You know, women are being induced. Their providers are not taking into account the fact that a woman is not really term until she's 40 weeks. A study released by HealthGrades, the nation's most trusted independent source of physician information and hospital quality outcomes, found the C-section rate in the United States rose from 27% of all singleton births to 34%. And healthy people in 2010 made cesarean, the rise in cesarean, one of the major objectives. And in 2020, they also included the issue of the rise in preterm birth. Now, we all recognize that there are some absolute indications for cesarean, such as placenta previa, placenta abruption, prolapse cord, and transverse lie. Next slide. I put this statistic up. Usually we don't include data from 1965, but I was in practice. I was a nurse in 1965. And this statistic just blows my mind that it was 4.5% and now we're 34%. I may say the word 34% several times because it's just so appalling. Cesarean rates can safely be less than 15% and 11% or less in low-risk women. Rates above 15%, and this is a really key point, seem to do more harm than good. So I want to talk briefly about some factors contributing to the rising cesarean birth rate. First of all, the overuse of common interventions, and I could just talk about common interventions, but just to list a few: routinely rupturing the membranes, continuously putting women on fetal monitoring, keeping them in bed, routine Pitocin inductions, or just to name a few. But there's also lack of recognition that cesarean is major surgery with many increased morbidities, as we've just heard. Lack of information, lack of awareness of morbidities for mother and baby, lack of recognition that it's major surgery, and not imparting this information to consumers. You know, we're just taking cesarean too casually. Our society seems to be more tolerant than ever of surgical procedures, even when not medically needed. This is reflected in the comfort level that many health professionals, insurance plans, hospital administrators, and women themselves seem to have with cesarean birth. Women are not being offered the option of VBAC. We have lost our skill in attending breech deliveries. We no longer know how to catch a breech baby. And many health professionals are being squeezed by tightened payments for services and increasing practice expenses. The flat global fee method of paying for childbirth does not provide any extra pay for providers who patiently support a longer vaginal birth. So, therefore, why sit at the bedside when you can just get that baby out? Some payment schedules pay more for cesarean than a vaginal birth. A planned cesarean is an especially efficient way for professionals to organize their hospital work, their office work, and their personal life. Average hospital charges are much greater for cesarean than vaginal birth, and many other hospitals, and many offer hospitals greater scope for profit. Sitting with a woman is just really time intensive. Next slide. So I mentioned preterm birth, and I mentioned it again because up until recently we've really seen an increase in preterm birth, and it's related to a lot of the interventions that unnecessary interventions that we're going to be addressing, and that many of the interventions that we're going to mention with our checklist. But one other key point that I want to mention about preterm birth is that people think that it's perfectly safe to be born at 34 to 36 weeks, not realizing that the baby's lungs and the baby's brain are not fully developed. A baby's brain at 35 weeks weighs only two-thirds of what it will weigh at 40 weeks. Because the brain development is not complete, these babies are at increased risk for learning and behavioral problems. Excellent. Thank you. So just a few final comments before I turn it over to Elaine. Cesarean births are clearly associated with preterm delivery. I mean, we're inducing women, we're inducing them early, and we're having an increase in cesarean births. Now, we all recognize that there's some things related to prematurity that we can't control. Like there's some women that are more at risk for preterm delivery. Those women who have a history of preterm delivery, women who have multiple gestation or uterine abnormalities. There are some things that are modified that we can change: smoking, drinking alcohol, illegal drugs, lack of social support, extremely high levels of stress, working long hours with periods of standing, environmental pollutants. All of these things are contributing factors to preterm births. We're going to talk now about some things that we can control and some unnecessary interventions.
Current hospital practices in labor and delivery suites evolved to improve pregnancy outcomes. All care providers really want the best for mothers and babies. But interventions that may be needed for the highest risk mothers are now being used on the majority of women who are, for the most part, low risk. Normal birth, as defined by the World Health Organization, is spontaneous in onset, is low risk at the start of labor, and remains low risk throughout labor. It is imperative that we do everything that we can to keep women low risk throughout their labor and birth. Maternal morbidity and near misses that she referred to, all of that can be avoided if we can keep women low risk throughout labor and birth. And we'd like to highlight some clinical pearls of midwifery practice which promote normal physiologic birth. Now, although these practices that I'm going to talk about are common for midwifery practice, they can actually be performed by any care provider in labor and delivery. Throughout history, women in labor have been attended by other women who are skilled in providing continuous emotional and physical support. As birth moved to hospitals, this component of care has been largely lost. The presence of a support person decreases the need for analgesia and provides the mother with a sense of well-being. There have actually been many, many studies done in the past 20 years that have shown that the presence of a continuous support person in labor increases the likelihood of a woman to have a vaginal birth, decreases the use of pain medication, increases a woman's opportunity to be more satisfied with their birth experience, and actually contributes to a shorter labor. So continuous labor support should clearly be the standard of care for all laboring women, and we're not doing that. Labor is an energy-intensive process, very similar to running a marathon. And the body needs nutrients to work most efficiently. Women should be allowed to eat and drink fluids in labor. Now, fasting in labor has been shown to increase gastric acid. The practice of preventing women from eating and drinking in labor became common because of the risk of aspiration during surgery. So that risk has to do with anesthesia. It's not about preventing women from vomiting. Not all women vomit in labor, and women vomit in labor whether they've eaten or not. So it really has to do with the anesthesia risk and with improvements in anesthesia techniques. Aspiration risk has really decreased. And in fact, a 2009 position statement from the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists recommends liquid intake during labor for all women. And women don't get hungry during the active phase of labor. There's delayed gastric emptying during active labor. They're not going to want to eat during active labor, but until they're in active labor, they really should be encouraged to follow their body's needs. We recommend avoiding routine IVs for all low-risk women. There has been no study ever that has shown that intravenous fluid during labor improves maternal or infant outcomes. In fact, we use intravenous fluid to decrease contractions in preterm labor. So why would we want to start IVs on women who are normal, low risk, and in good labor? What we're going to do is slow down their labor by starting IVs. IV access should be reserved for women who are at high risk for complications, or for women who need antibiotics, or for women who need epidurals. The widespread use of continuous electronic fetal monitoring confines most laboring women to bed. There have been many, many studies of the use of electronic fetal monitoring on low-risk women, and most of those studies have shown, and actually a Cochrane analysis comparing EFM to intermittent auscultation shows that EFM is associated with increased cesarean births, increased vacuum and forceps deliveries, and no difference in perinatal outcomes of perinatal mortality, cerebral palsy, or Apgar scores. And intermittent auscultation allows freedom of movement in labor, which helps the normal progression of labor. And again, ACOG has a position statement from 2009 that states, given that available data do not clearly support electronic fetal monitoring over intermittent auscultation, either option is acceptable in a patient without complications. Another common intervention routinely used in hospital labor and delivery suites is to encourage women to push. There's this rush once a woman is fully dilated to get the baby out. Several studies have shown that the use of that kind of bearing down results in adverse fetal acidosis or deoxygenation and a decrease in umbilical cord pH values. It increases maternal fatigue. It causes more perineal tears. It causes decreased urogynecologic function afterwards and decreased bladder capacity. And it challenges a woman's confidence in her own body. We recommend that the second stage of labor, which begins when a woman is fully dilated and ready to push, be individualized based on what the woman's body is telling her. So these practices that I've just briefly described, along with several others, such as encouraging women to be upright and mobile, allowing the amniotic sac to rupture on its own, not routinely cutting episiotomies, all of these kinds of practices could easily be implemented for all low-risk women, and there's evidence for all of them that documents their safety and their link to improved pregnancy outcome. So how do we help care providers listen to the evidence and make changes in their practice? So, checklists. Is everyone familiar with the idea of checklists for patient safety, right? This is really well known now. The most famous example, of course, is that of reducing infections in central line catheters in cardiac care units, a process that was developed at Johns Hopkins Hospital, reducing their infection rate from 30% to 0%. In the past 10 years, checklists have been developed for a variety of clinical pathways, from responses to stroke and myocardial infarction to the proper responses for a psychotic patient in the emergency room. Using checklists requires a team approach to patient care and has been shown to change hospital culture from a doctor-centrist view, in which a doctor's orders or a doctor's practices are never questioned, to a patient-centrist view, where all healthcare providers work in concert to assure that all steps in a given clinical pathway are implemented correctly. There was a landmark study, again done by the Cochrane Analysis Group, that recommended that midwife-led models of care were the optimal model of care for all laboring women. So, how do we change that hospital culture? This is a checklist that the American College of Nurse Midwives has developed to help promote normal physiologic birth. The checklist is actually part of a larger PowerPoint presentation that showcases the evidence supporting practices that promote normal physiologic birth. Midwives are beginning to use this presentation and the checklist. The presentation is being given at Grand Rounds for physicians and nurses in hospital OB units around the country. Midwifery educators are arming their students, both nursing students and midwifery students, with laminated copies of this checklist. And our aim is really to change the culture of labor and birth practice. Labor is one of the major life events a woman will experience. Its memory will remain with her for her whole life. A woman's confidence and ability to give birth and to care for her baby are enhanced or diminished by every person who gives her care and by the environment in which she gives birth. Increased dependence on technology has diminished women's confidence in their ability to give birth without intervention. We believe this checklist can help to change the current culture to an environment that promotes normal physiologic birth. And we have listed for you many of the references that promote these clinical pearls. Thank you.